It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 533 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a special guest and Eisner-nominated creator, Ibrahim Mustafa. His latest book is Retroactive, and it's coming from Humanoids, and it's coming out this week. He also recently released Count, a reimagined story of the Count of Monte Cristo, and he's got other books coming as well. We talk about how the books came to be, who the characters are, as well as other offerings Ibrahim has coming our way soon. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get through in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Ibrahim Mustafa, the creator of some great books that are coming out from Humanoids right now. And the next one's going to be called Retroactive, coming out on the 26th of April. How you doing, Ibrahim?
I'm doing well, Wayne. Thank you for having me.
It's good to talk with you. Why don't we talk a little bit about Retroactive? You've got a three-book deal, and one already came out, and that was Count. And we'll talk about that one a little later. But Retroactive is the next one. So what we want to do is we want to be sure to get everything squared away on that one before we go back to Count. So let's see. The description of Retroactive is a sci-fi tale about an agent working for the U.S. Bureau of Temporal Affairs who sets out to discover the source of several anomalies in the timeline, only to become imprisoned in an inescapable time loop. So where did the idea come for that?
Well, the elevator pitch that I've been using for this book is James Bond meets Groundhog Day. And that's pretty much where it came from. I love espionage. I love, you know, I've worked on James Bond comics. I'm a big, big Bond fan. And I love time travel stories, and I love especially time loop stories. And I thought, you know what, those are two genres that have never been mashed up together. So, you know, let me see what I can figure out for that. So, yeah, that was the impetus of it.
Okay. Wow. Okay. How long did it take for you to come up with the idea and then get it into a book form?
Well, you know, I had been kicking around the idea of like, how do I do a cool time loop story for a couple years? And when it came time to pitch my second book in my three-book deal with Humanoids, I was like, okay, you know, I think it's time to finally do this one. So over the years, I've taken stabs at it, you know, written out some ideas and things like that. And then ultimately, when it came time to actually pitch it, that's, you know, when I was formulating the pitch document that has the kind of plot synopsis and whatnot, that was when it really kind of came to be in, you know, the closest to the final form that it would end up becoming. So. And then from there, you know, over the course of about a year, I worked on it. This one went slow. I did Count in about 7 months beginning to end. And they're both 120 pages, but this one, you know, it's much more complicated, storyline wise, cause I was dealing with, you know, different timelines and things like that. And then also figuring out the logic of it all and the rules of this time travel and then of course the pandemic hit. And so that kind of like threw everybody for a bit of a whirl, you know? Yeah. So, this one probably, I guess closer about 10 months, something like that to finish.
Cool. Well, it sounds like you're interested in science fiction or sci-fi, as some people refer to it.
Yeah. You know, I'm not like the biggest sci-fi, I don't tend to, you know, like I'm not a big Star Trek person or something like, you know, or not really that into Star Wars or anything, but I enjoy the sort of Black Mirror kind of sci-fi, right? Where it's like a little bit more modern and, you know, like our current lives, but augmented slightly by technology type of thing.
It's off center.
Yeah.
Things. Yeah, I enjoy that too. I really do. I am a Star Trek kind of guy, so it doesn't matter to me. I like all different variations of science fiction and stuff like that appeals to me. So I'm very happy to see it. When I started to read about retroactive, I was really kind of intrigued as to how you were going to handle it, because time loop stuff can be, as you were alluding to, can be really confusing and hard to follow. But I found the book really easy to read, so I thought you handled it really well.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you. Yeah, that was definitely something that I put a lot of time and care into making in a way that was not going to be too confusing. And so I tried to, you know, have enough visual cues throughout the book to kind of help the reader along in terms of, okay, we're resetting here, or, you know, this is like there are two timelines in the book, and one of them has, you know, narration monologue type of text and the other one doesn't. So there's some, you know, visual markers as well as some storytelling devices that, you know, were intended to help people kind of keep the threads straight.
Now, you're a writer artist, as you've been described. Are you a writer who draws, or are you an artist who writes?
I would definitely categorize myself as the latter, an artist who writes. Yeah, it's a tricky thing, because comics are a visual medium, and yet, you know, writers get all the credit. And there were several times where I would just get so frustrated when a writer that I worked with, you know, and it's always a great collaboration, but you'd see something that you did as the artist and the writer's getting praised for it. And, you know, I eventually kind of got to a point where I was like, you know what, I think I can do this myself. And I think I would have more fun if it were all coming out of me. And, you know, it's kind of like, I use this analogy a lot, but it's like dressing yourself as opposed to having someone else pick out your clothes for you.
Never heard it described that way before. That's interesting. Because, you know, it's so interesting, because usually when I talk to other folks, they always tell me that it's the artists that get all the attention. You know, which book is Todd McFarlane drawn? Who cares who's writing it? It just matters that Todd McFarlane's drawing it. So I'm kind of interested to hear you say that, because from my perspective, it took a long time for writers to start to get recognition. So it's interesting to hear that perspective. I haven't heard that very much.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, I think Todd McFarlane is a bit of a false equivalency, because it's like, of course, he's Todd McFarlane. Like, he's his own, mm-hmm. you know, this guy's mm-hmm. he's a business, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it really came about for maybe a couple of reasons. I think partially it was a byproduct of, you know, your McFarlanes and your Jim Lees and whatnot, like leaving, you know, the artists got so big that they could go start their own company and make millions over there. And so, you know, the companies were like, oh, we need to, you know, they're getting a little big for their britches, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then, you know, then of course you had writers like Alan Moore and Grant Morrison and, you know, a lot of real heady, high concept folks coming into comics and, you know, really setting themselves apart. And then from there, I think it just became a lot more writer driven from the top down in terms of, you know, planning events and things like that. So, and, you know, and telling long storylines and whatnot. And the fact of the matter is, writers can just do more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because writing it doesn't take as much time as the art. I mean, a writer can work on multiple titles in a month, and an artist can only do one, maybe two, if they're someone like, you know, Chris Somney, who's very fast or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's, you know, and then of course, we're in the age of, you know, the internet and online reviews and whatnot. And I think a lot of folks who write reviews are writers themselves. And so the scales were tipped in that direction in terms of the critique of comics, because that's what the parts that they were talking about, because that's what they could identify with, you know, artists, and being able to talk about art is a very specific language. And I think a lot of folks, you know, both, you know, if you're not an artist yourself or a big fan of art, you don't have the language to do it. And so it's easier to talk about the writing, because we all kind of understand that part.
You know, I've often interviewed artists, and it took me a while to get the language down a little bit, and what to ask them, you know, as far as like, how did you decide to do that? Or what did you pattern this after your own imagination? Or were you drawing the person to resemble somebody and things like that? I've often talked to writer or artists, and I'll ask a writer question to the writer, and then I'll turn to the artist and ask them an artist type question, you know, just to make sure that everybody gets a chance to say something.
Sure. And
talk about their thing. Of course, with you, I can ask anything. So that's a,
yeah,
that's a great thing. Everything that goes, well, I'm just kind of curious though, as you know, and I've often asked people who are writer / artists, they usually tell me they're just a storyteller is the way they want to be described. They don't want to, they don't fall into the two other categories that I mentioned. So
sure.
It's interesting to hear that. But as far as you, of course, you know, when you're drawing your own story, if you think of something when you're in the middle of drawing, you can change something along the way if you need to.
To an extent. I mean, you know, you still have to work with an editor and have them, you know, approve the script for drawing. Mm-hmm. So, if there's something that's going to be like a drastic change, you definitely want to run it by them. And, you know, so it's not, the process isn't too different, but, you know, for example, if I'm drawing a page and I realize that I don't need this panel. I don't have to ask anyone before just, you know, cutting that panel or, you know, if I decide at some point, you know what, I think the facial expression sells this. I don't need the dialogue for this panel. I can just, you know, take it away. Whereas, you know, you don't want to step on somebody's toes if you're collaborating. So that's a, that's a whole, and then of course, you know, generally like each collaborator wants their part to be seen and known. So, you know, sometimes it can be difficult to be like, hey, let's take your contribution away from this panel because, you know, we don't need it because I did it, you know? So yeah, from that angle, it's definitely a bit easier to make changes on the fly.
Well, I've watched writers write these massive word balloons full of all kinds of text. And I'm sitting going, you know, I don't think I really need to read that whole thing. I'll wait and they'll explain it a couple pages. I'll say it visually a couple pages from now.
Right.
So writers hate it when I say that, but it's the way I kind of do things. You're right when you see a comics or a visual medium often. And so if you sit there and try to do, you know, too many words, you tend to lose people because of that. But it's good. I mean, how do you approach that, though, as far as, you know, words, the number of words and creation of dialogue and stuff like that? Do you approach it for how it looks on a page, or how do you go at it?
Well, I try to keep it to what serves the story and what moves it forward. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain things that you'll need it for character moments and things like that. But, if the general rule I try to keep in mind is show, don't tell. So if it's something I can do with a drawing, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as far as like the number of words, there's kind of a rule of thumb. I think it's something like 28 words per word balloon or maybe I think it's per word balloon. Mm-hmm. So that kind of gives you, you know, and that's not set in stone or anything, but it's just kind of like one of those benchmarks you keep in mind. So I try to say whatever I'm saying, I'll do another pass on a script, and then I try to reduce it to like the least, you know, possible number of words in order to get it across so that it's not too word heavy. Mm-hmm. You know, every now and then you do need the expository stuff and things like that. So you got to find ways to break that up as much as you can. But yeah, you know, I certainly subscribe to the less is more approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to hear because I some people who are artists, when they start to write, they overcompensate and it's just mountains and mountains of words. And I'm going like, I don't think that makes it so easy to read. I like it when it's a lot more, like you say, boiled down and cut down to just what we need is really all that we want to read, I think.
Yeah, and that's something too every new writer does, whether, you know, they came from being an artist or not. It's like whenever I've worked with somebody who's newer in their career, you know, especially when I was newer in their career or newer in my career, you get these script pages and you're just like, there's no way that this will, you know, so, and you know, it's funny, like I'll sit down and read a prose book, but if I flip open a comic page and there's too many word balloons, I'm just like, ugh.
Yeah, I know. You know? I know.
It's something about the medium. I think we, you know, our brains go, I don't want all that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're used to thinking visually when we're reading a comic.
Right.
And if we have to read too many words, it's, I mean, I fault Alan Moore in some ways because he loved big verbose panels, and I would look at it and I would go, I'd love to read all that, Alan, but I just can't make it. So I move on to other stuff. But it's interesting that I was just curious how the balance is struck with you. It sounds like in some ways you've broken it down visually, you know, how many words and what kind of things you should do in a panel. So that's a good way to approach it, I think. I wish more writers would do that, honestly.
Well, you know, I do think it's one of the benefits of being an artist as well, is that, you know, when I'm doing layouts for a page, I have to look at the script, and I you know, not everybody does this, but a lot of artists will, and I do this myself, you draw in the balloons, you know, and kind of plot out where they're going to go, so that, not as like a final guide for the letter or anything, but just so you know how much room you have. Mm-hmm. And so you get a good idea after doing it so many times of, you know, where, how much space you've actually got. And so that helps me, you know, as I go, I can look at lines of dialogue in the script and go, that's way too much, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, that's the right way to do it. Of course, you don't do the lettering though, right?
No, we have Haas for that. Hassan, Otman El-Hao. He's one of the more prolific letterers in comics right now. And he's just fantastic. Like he'll take some really cool swings, you know, with some of the sound effects, especially as far as like how he works them into the scene, you know, in the panel. And then we've got Brad Simpson on colors, who's just phenomenal. And the two of them actually kind of work in tandem, because, Haas will make the sound effects and then, Brad will color them. So it's been a really fun kind of, you know, collaboration thing we've got going on.
Good. Was that true for both of the volumes that we've seen so far?
Yes. Same teams.
Really? Well, that's great. It's great when you can do those kinds of things. That's really great fun to have. Now,
yeah,
let's get into the books, the book themselves. We'll start off with, of course, the Retroactive. Who is the main character in that book?
His name is Tariq Abdel Nasser, and he is you know, a guy who works for this Bureau of Temporal Affairs, and he's also got a mother who's got dementia. And so he's trying to take care of her and do his job. And, you know, his job is fairly secret, so he can't really talk about it. And, you know, he's got a sister overseas who's kind of breathing down his neck about taking care of their mom. And, you know, mm-hmm. he's frustrated because it's like, well, I'm here, you know, and mm-hmm. you're not. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, he's, as he finds himself stuck in this loop, he's wondering, you know, he's trying to keep everything straight. And, you know, is he starting to wonder, like, am I also getting dementia? Like, is this hereditary? Am I, you know? So yeah, he's got his work cut out for him.
Now, when the book starts out, he's in an interesting time and place. He's in Nazi-occupied France in 1940, and he sets his sights on Hitler, who's going through the streets, which, of course, you know, that old conundrum, you know, if you could kill Hitler,
yeah,
would you? And he has to kind of, that's one of the subjects he has to kind of deal with early in the story. So it's really a very interesting place to start, because that sucked me right in. I was like, ooh, how's this going to work out?
Good, good. Yeah. You said it, right? That's the question that comes up with every time travel thing. And so I wanted to address it right off the bat in a very, you know, James Bond like opening pre-credit sequence where, you know, you get the action and the setting and you meet the players and you figure out what's going on. Because that is, you know, this Bureau of Temporal Affairs is essentially the CIA of time travel. Mm-hmm. You know, the book takes place in, you know, the not too distant future, where government agencies have this technology, and there's this kind of Cold War brewing around it, where, you know, maybe Russia goes back to try to stop something from happening in the US's past to weaken them in the future. And so, you know, these agencies exist to police that, and then also to, you know, avert terror attacks and disasters and things like that. So, you know, there's a lot of questions about morality and which things do you stop, or which do you have to ensure that they happen the way that they did, even though it's a terrible thing, because it could completely alter the future, you know, in a negative way for the country or whatever. So that's the struggle that they're dealing with.
So who makes those choices? Is it the agency?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't really get into it in the book, because it's, you know, a bit dry subject matter, but the idea that I've kind of had in my head is like, you know, there's, you know, joint chiefs committees and Senate intel briefings and things like that. And it's sort of, you know, maybe the president is involved in the final say and whatnot. So very similar to like, who do we go to war with and who do we not, you know, who's there's a director of the agency the same way there would be at the CIA. And, you know, they're choosing which missions and whatnot. So, yeah, you know, all that kind of stuff that I, you know, really enjoy about like spy fiction. I kind of wanted to sprinkle into this.
But it really comes together really well. The action is really handled well. And I always judge art by two things. I judge it by facial expressions and action sequences. And I thought both of them really were really strong.
Thank you.
Artwork. So it's really great stuff. Now, one of the things I thought you did really well with the main character that made him really identifiable was the business with his mother. Do you mind talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I think when you're dealing with something like time travel and it's, you know, 30 years in the future from now kind of thing, it's easy to kind of lose the basis in reality because it's this, you know, kind of made up thing. And so I think it's really important to anchor the characters in a way that is very relatable, you know, no matter what time you're reading this in. And so, and also just from a thematical standpoint of, you know, the sort of cyclical nature of time that I play with in this story, I thought it was really interesting to have somebody who's losing their memory. And so, yeah, I just really wanted to have something to anchor him for readers that was relatable.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I was always thinking he could always go back in time and see his mother. You know, that she's not doing all that well at the time of a lot of the stories going on. If it was me, I would have gone back in time when she was really well and experienced that. But
right.
He doesn't necessarily want to go that route. So that,
well, that's one of the things that, you know, he has to deal with in his job is like, he even tells the new recruit about it when he's kind of taking her through the training jump. Like, you can't go back in time for your own reasons, you know, mm-hmm. like that's one of the rules. And so he's very, you know, staunch about the, you know, playing by the book, in the beginning. And then you start to see him kind of get disillusioned with it. And, you know, you're kind of on that journey with him as, you know, when he kind of realizes like, maybe we aren't doing good here. Like maybe we're actually a bigger problem than I thought.
Mm-hmm. Which is great, Chris. That's the great thing about time travel and asking those questions. If we could, would we, or should
right.
we?
Right. So, and in this case, you kind of get, okay, well, we did. Now what? You know, was it good or not?
They can't go back and undo what they did, right?
I mean, theoretically, they could, you know, they could go back over and over again. And in some cases, they have to, you know, like when there's a sequence with the Kennedy assassination and he mentions right. like, oh, right. we have a drift site there because it's been targeted before. So, but, you know, theoretically there'd be different outcomes every time. And so, and that's kind of how we get, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but that's a bit of how we learn about these time loops. Like he's stuck in is, you know, that it's kind of a byproduct of that.
Mm-hmm. I really thought you hit all the high points when it comes to time travel, Hitler and then JFK's assassination, things like that. Draw me in because I'm always wondering what if we did something differently, what would have happened?
Yeah.
So you kind of address some of that in there, which I think is great.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, I also wanted stuff that was going to be recognizable on a global scale, in terms of historical events, you know, cause you could set something in the past and if it's like not that recognizable to readers, then it just doesn't really resonate as well, I don't think. But if you have, you know, these two very major historical events and people and whatnot, it's like, oh, okay, like I get what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. I love the name retroactive, the idea. And of course, in some parts, the retro is slightly above the active part. And of course, the retro meaning time and active being things going on. I like that because sometimes science fiction names don't make a lot of sense to me. This one did.
Thank you. Yeah. Like. I'm a big fan of things, you know, titles with like kind of double meaning. So, you know, it's retroactive as in they go back and retroactively change things, but also like they are active in, you know, retro times. And I did the same thing with Count. You know, it's a remix of the Count of Monte Cristo, but it also, you know, there's a major theme throughout the book of like making yourself count, making your chances and opportunities count.
Mm-hmm. Well, this book is going to be out on the 26th of April, which is like a Tuesday. I think it's going to be out in bookstores on Tuesday and then hopefully the next day in comic shops. So
correct.
That'd be great because the humanoids and stuff like that. It's just a great story. I do have to say I got to read the whole story and it is gripping. I could not stop reading it once I started. It was just a – then when I get to the end, I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's actually feedback I've been getting quite a bit so far is that people read it in one sitting. That means a lot because, you know, you don't want to think someone's putting your book down and going and, you know, playing a video game or something. So,
I got to finish that. I better get back to it kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could not stop reading it. And I was so interested as to what was going to happen next. And I thought the ending was really well done. I have troubles with comic endings a lot of the times, and one comic company in particular, they always lead into another event, and so there's not really any kind of conclusion or something we can hang our hat on.
Sure.
But you have a really interesting way of ending it, and I thought that's really an interesting way to do that. And, of course, do you have any other stories you might do in this universe?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I kind of left it to where – I certainly could, but, you know, I really enjoy the kind of done in one nature of like a trade paperback where it almost feels like you just watched a movie, you know? But yeah, I mean, you know, I'll never say never.
Well, if it goes big time and they say, you got any more of that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe I do.
A lot of times that's when you figure out if you do, right? Is they go, hey.
Well, the old story was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was supposed to be a one-shot. And Eastman and Laird did this thing. And then they got printed and hit the stores. And they thought, well, that was fun. And then all of a sudden, Diamond calls them up and says, where's the next issue?
Right.
And they said, next issue. Hey, we can do that. So that's when they went and did those kinds of things. But it's always interesting to me. Success breeds other stories, which is always a great thing. But this is so well done. I do have to – I highly recommend it because it's so much fun. Because like I said, time travel can be a mess. But this is a very organized, understandable story being told. And boy, do I treasure that when it comes to time travel and stuff like that.
Thank you very much.
Very, very good. So, okay, why don't we talk about the other one, Count? You mentioned it briefly. I get a kick when I hear it called Count because, you know, these days we're trying to boil down things into like one word. I was driving by and I was going to look at Dunkin' Donuts and suddenly the donuts disappeared.
Right. It's just Dunkin'. Yeah.
It's just Dunkin' now. And I'm like, that's kind of an interesting way to do it. And now they say, you know, the logo and the catchphrase and everything has to do with just Dunkin', the donuts of all, because they don't want to not just be donuts. And stuff
right.
Like so Count, and you mentioned that there's kind of a double meaning as far as the word count too. So I found that really interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because in comics right now, we're actually in this time of really long titles, you know. And maybe I'm just, you know, not trendy, but I like I just enjoy a nice, clean, concise single word if I can get it, you know.
I think that's a good thing because honestly, you've only got a few seconds to grab people's attention. You know, you got video games to fight with, TV, movies, all these other things are trying to grab people's attention. So if you don't sharply and concisely get people's attention right away, you're in trouble. So I thought count was a great way to do it. It's, you know, of course, when I saw that, I wasn't sure what count what was. Is somebody counting something? What is that? So I wanted to know. And so that got me my attention right away. I had to figure out what is the count stand for? What's it talking about?
So, yeah, you know, I like that it also kind of, it's almost like an instruction too, you know, like, if you see it, you might be like, why is that book telling me to count? You know, and then you're like, oh.
Math is not my strong suit, so I necessarily
want to. Nor mine.
But the thing that's really interesting, okay, this is different from the other book because the other book, this is your story, right?
Yes.
This one is you taking a familiar story and doing your unique spin on it.
Right.
So that's kind of an interesting way to approach it. I mean, was it a different way to do the book than the other one? I mean, was the process pretty much the same?
No, you know, I think, I definitely had the framework of, you know, the kind of the broad strokes. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but to make it my own, I really had to really just change a bunch of stuff. So, I mean, you know, you have the sort of basic premise of like, you know, a young poor sailor is wrongfully convicted of treason and sent mm-hmm. away to a prison. And then he, you know, escapes and takes out his revenge. Mm-hmm. But you know, the original Count of Monte Cristo was very, very long and kind of soap operatic. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. think there was a single sword drawn mm-hmm. anywhere in the story, maybe at the very end. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas this, I tried to make it a very action heavy, swashbuckling kind of, you know, adventure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then there's robots in it, which clearly weren't in the, you know, 17th century France, version. So, And then, you know, I make it a lot more about a sort of brewing revolution as opposed to just kind of like one guy's journey.
Well, the beginning of the story really grabbed me because, you know, here's this guy, he gets promoted to captain. And he's so happy about it. I mean, it opens all kinds of doors for him. But, of course, that doesn't – there's reasons why he's promoted to captain, we find out along the way. And I felt for him. I really felt sorry for this guy because here he is. He was so thrilled and ecstatic. Here's an opportunity he couldn't wait to take advantage of, and suddenly it blows up in his face. And I felt so badly for him. And he has to go through all kinds of things to try to set things right. And I really, right away, I got an interest in his character and I wanted to see him succeed because he'd been so badly treated.
No, I appreciate that. That's wonderful to hear. He really has the world on a string and then it just gets, you know, and that's how fast it can happen, you know, mm-hmm. in the real world too, just the blink of an eye and everything mm-hmm. you hold dear is taken from you. So I really wanted to try to, you know, evoke that sense with this.
Now, what was that character's name?
Redzan Samud. And it's interesting because the name Samud in Arabic means like strong of will. Mm-hmm. But what I was doing is I was just remixing Alexandre Dumas just kind of, you know, doing a little tribute to the original author of the original story.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty cool. I liked it. You're right. You've got more science fiction stuff going on. He's in a jail that like a floating prison and he's got to try to get out of it. He's got to try to figure out what to do. He meets somebody in the jail and that takes things a different direction, which is kind of fun to do. How different did you feel you could make it and still be somewhat true to the original?
You know, I felt like I pretty much had free rein. I mean, if you're going to say it's based on this thing, then you've got to, you know, at least be somewhat true to the story. But I mean, you know, adding the sci-fi element to it really just opens up a whole world of possibilities. And so, mm-hmm. You know, I go pretty far afield from the original in mm-hmm. a lot of ways. And, you know, the ending's different. The mm-hmm. a lot of the characters are different. Mm-hmm. So that was a nice thing. I mean, I didn't feel pigeonholed by the original at all. I knew I was just kind of referencing it as a framework, but I was really going to remix it to be my own thing.
Because some people don't want that. I have a friend of mine who, if a TV show is based on a comic and it doesn't follow the comic exactly,
right.
They are like, that's not right. That's not the way it should be. I'm trying to remember that was John Carter, I think was the movie. And it was based on novels and he had read the novels. And when he went to the theater and it didn't follow the novels, he was screaming in the middle of the theater. That's not right. That's not the way it's supposed to be.
Oh, wow.
And I said to him later, I said, did they throw you out? Well, yeah, but I was like, yeah, of course they did.
Oh, wow.
Other people weren't sitting there doing that. I'm always interested how far people feel they can go. Because like I said, this one guy, he wants it It's like a comic on the screen. He wants it just like Frank Miller would do. He would take and shoot the spirit and stuff like that in a way that resembled the comic. But the thing that was interesting was that some people, I don't want that. I want the screen, the thing on the comic, to take advantage of the medium. I don't necessarily want you to do, something that doesn't work in the comic medium. So for me, I thought that was a great story because, you took advantage of the comic medium. You moved in certain ways that comics really do best. And so for me, I really liked it. I thought that was the way to go and do it. I won't show it to my friend, though, because I'm afraid what he'd say.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, if he's a real big fan of the 1,100-page novel from 200 years ago, he might not enjoy this one as much. But yeah, and I think, there's a big difference between like adapting something for screen, from like when they made Watchmen, for example. You want to see Watchmen and changing the ending or changing the outcome of the story was kind of like, that's not Watchmen,
Yeah, right.
Whereas this, it's like, if you say, it's inspired by, or it's, loosely based on, then you get a lot more. And I think also the age of the original novel, being a few hundred years old. And then, also, I mean, it's kind of the progenitor of the revenge story, right? Like, like so many things are based on it. Like the movie Old Boy, for example, or the Mask of Zorro, the Antonio Banderas movie, has a lot of Count of Monte Cristo parallels. So I think there's a lot more free rein to do something when it's older and like a looser adaptation.
Well, I got to ask you again, is there any chance of more stories in that realm?
With this one, yes. Yeah.
You mean continue with the same character or same situation? How would you move forward? I don't want to take away from what you might want to do with it, but how would you do that?
Well, my intent is to focus on one character from this book that was not a big player and then set the book in the same world, but a different part of the world.
Okay.
And tell a different kind of story with it.
Hmm.
So just kind of building on the tapestry without, doing like a count two, here's the continuing adventures of Red Zan or anything like that. So,
yeah, it was a fun book to read. It was really interesting. Again, the characters grabbed me and what was going on. I was a real page turner. Again, I could not stop to do anything. I had to make sure I read the whole book and I got to the end and I was really intrigued by the ending and how it went. So I just really enjoyed that book. Both of these books, I think, would make wonderful movies.
Well, thank you for the kind words, man. I mean, yeah, if they want to give me a bunch of money to do, I would more than happily take it and keep making the comics I want to make,
So you wouldn't care if they changed the story? Because one of the complaints I've often heard from people I've interviewed who have had to do when they've had their story and it hits the producers say, this would be better if we did this.
Right.
This would be better. And they sit there and say, well, why did they want my story if they weren't going to use it? Kind of stuff. So I'm always interested when I ask people that. Some people say, if they want to give me a lot of money, they can do whatever they want.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would certainly love to see it, shot for shot. As an adaptation, but I told the story I wanted to tell, and I think that it existing as a comic is just as valid as it existing as a movie, and so to me they're on the same level, and so I kind of look at it like, yeah, it exists in this form and in the ultimate form that it will be in. And so if somebody wants to do something else with it, as long as I'm taken care of, I'm more than happy to sit back and let them,
One thing, of course, when I read both of the stories, being a long-term comic reader, the first thing I thought was crossover. We can have the temporal people go and see him in the future in the prison and stuff like that and see if they want to change history and stuff like that.
Well, in my headcanon, Count takes place in kind of a different world. You know, I don't come out and say what it's called or anything like that, but you know, the names and the technology are different. And so, that was one of the fun things about it is kind of doing the world building. And that's why revisiting it would be a lot of fun, is because I feel like there's a lot more to be done with the visuals in this place and that their technology that, you know, just, I didn't have the space to get to in this volume.
It's interesting because there are a lot of comics people who I read who don't like world building. They want to everything to happen in the city of New York, where everything is exactly the way that we know it in real life, kind of stuff. And I'm always kind of like, I don't know. I've been to New York. I'd like to see other places and stuff like that. So I enjoyed your world building. That was one of the things I meant to mention about how both of the stories, both of the books really did a good job of creating a setting and drawing me into it.
Well, thank you.
And I'd like to see more of that, because I think that's one thing comics don't do enough of, is world building and making things that we haven't, or places we haven't gone before, and making them interesting. So I like that.
You know, I think that's another one of the benefits of being the both the artist and the writer, because world building is so prevalent in prose, right? I mean, it's all over, you know, fantasy novels and sci-fi novels, and I you get to do that when you get to describe a lot of things. But I think when you have a writer and artist as collaborators rather than a single person, you know, then the writer is put in the position of writing these super long panel descriptions, and the artist is like, why are you telling me all this? You know, so I think, you know, with Count, for example, like a lot of it just lived in my head and I just drew it. I didn't, you know, do a ton of concept art. I did a bit for the pitch package to let them know like what the world was, you know, kind of the direction it was going in. But, you know, a lot of the stuff just kind of came about as I was drawing it. Like once I had the internal logic going, it was easy to just kind of go, okay, now I'm going to do this.
You know, it's interesting because for a while I was part of a fan film script writing group, and I had this story, it was a Star Trek one, and I had this story in my head. There were no aliens on the Star Trek ship, and I had to find out or figure out why. So we wrote this, I had in my head this thing, and I carried it around in my head for about 2 years. And then we started to write the script, and when the script was finally finished, I got this really weird rush that hit me, because here the story I've been lugging around in my brain for 2 years was now on paper.
Yeah.
And some people tell me they get that same thing when they work on a project for a really long time. Then suddenly when it's down on the page, it's not inside them anymore. It's kind of a different feeling for them. Did you ever get that with either of these?
Oh, definitely. I mean, both were some, you know, stories that I thought about for a long time in different iterations, especially Count. I actually found, I was cleaning out my email inboxes and stuff, and I found an email that I had sent to myself 3 years prior to Count being, I think 3 years prior to the pitch being accepted, where, you know, I had sent myself an email that just simply said Count of Monte Cristo, but sci-fi. So, yeah, that was a cool artifact to find. And, you know, especially as it had kind of come full circle by that point.
Oh, great. Well, it certainly came through. Both of the stories really felt well thought out, well told stories. And so I really liked that, because, you know, with comics, a lot of the times the monthly grind doesn't help people tell good stories, in my mind. But yours were, when they were ready, then they were sent out. So I really liked the both of them for that reason. I could tell that you had really put a lot of effort and a lot of thought and a lot of work into both of these books. So they really do show, and they're really, really intelligent.
Well, thank you. That really means a lot, Wayne. I appreciate that.
Now, as far as other projects you're working on, what else are you working on that you can talk with us about?
Well, on April 20th, I've got a Doctor Strange one-shot that I drew at Marvel coming out. That's written by Ralph Macchio and colored by Niraj Menon. And it's a really fun kind of just sort of like, you know, flashback story of Doctor Strange dealing with some sleep issues that are brought on by a team-up of Baron Mordo and Nightmare. And so, you know, it's just a one and done 20-page one shot that's just like, if you love Doctor Strange and sort of that good old style of Marvel comics, it's very much written to be like kind of a tribute to the Lee Ditko era of Doctor Strange.
Is that you did the thing writer artist there as well?
No, that one was written by Ralph Macchio, who's a long time.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, no worries. It might be Macchio. I'm not sure.
I never know. Pronunciation, but,
and then I've also got another book coming out in May that I wrote and drew with a new publisher called Fair Square Comics. It's actually headed by Fabrice Sapolsky, who was my original editor at Humanoids, who brought Count into the fold over there. He has since branched out with his own imprint, and this is coming out through their classified line. It's called Jaeger, and it was actually a digital first comic that I wrote and drew back in 2016. And I've got nominated for an Eisner Award for best best digital comic at the time.
Wow, great!
And it's a post World War II spy story. So it's basically about a guy who was a spy for the Allies. He worked for the Special Operations Executive, which is a precursor to MI6. Mm-hmm. And he was held in a Nazi prison camp. And then, you know, once the war ended, he was freed, and the Nazis just kind of like, you know, escaped to South America, or, you know, some went to work for the US under Project Paperclip. And so, you know, he's left disillusioned by this, like, no, these guys, you know, killed millions and now we're just letting them go. So he's kind of on a one man revenge mission, you know, going hunting them down himself. And then he's approached by a former colleague who's with MI6 now. And she says, hey, you know, officially, you shouldn't be doing that. Unofficially, the prime minister is pretty unhappy about the situation with the escaped Nazis as well. And we have a list of them that we know are still alive, but they have falsified death certificates. So technically these men don't exist, and therefore you can't get in trouble for killing them. So she kind of supplies him with the information and says, like, you know, we'll disavow you if you get caught, but, you know, go do your thing. So, you know, it's kind of a globe-trotting story where he's going around and, you know, trying to find the man who imprisoned him, and, you know, it deals with revenge and the cost of it. And, you know, do you become like your oppressor if you, you know, work hard enough to seek that revenge? And so, yeah, I'm really excited that it's, you know, I've done some self-published print runs for conventions and stuff, but this is the first time it's going to be out through Diamond in the direct market. So
how do you spell Jaeger, by the way?
Jaeger.
Okay. Some people use a Y, and I want people to know so we can, I want to know so I can track it down and stuff like
that. Yeah. And the prefix is like, it's classified colon Jaeger.
Oh, okay.
But I think if you type Jaeger, it should come up because it's, you know, the only one. So
very good. Now, if we want to follow you on social media, how do we do that?
Best way is to go to IbrahimMustafa.com. That's IbrahimMustafa.com. And there are links to my Instagram, my Twitter, and my YouTube channel on the bottom of the page there.
Cool. Okay. And those are the best places to keep up with your stuff?
Yep. Yeah. I'm, you know, I share artwork on both platforms, and then on YouTube, I actually do a lot of customizing of action figures and custom builds of action figure vehicles and stuff. And so I've got some tutorials up there and just some walkthroughs of the stuff I've made. And, so yeah. And then trailers for the books, obviously. So you can check out a trailer for Count and, for Retroactive on there as well.
Cool. Well, they're great books, I have to say. I got a chance to read them when they come out in paper copies. I'm already after Count, trying to get that one in the paper copy so I can have those to keep. But just great books, and I hope you keep doing more and more of this because, man, you do both really, really well. So whether you just write or just – have you ever just written the story, or have you always done the writer-artist?
Yeah, always done the writer-artist thing. Okay. I've, you know – There may be some time in the future where I do that. If I just, you know, I have a story that I really want to do, but I don't have the time to draw it because I'm working on something else or something. But, you know, I get the most joy out of the full process. And then, you know, if I had to pick one, I'd probably be drawing because that's my first love. So,
well, they're both great because the Count was really great. And I also liked Retroactive. So, again, if you want to get those, they're up from Humanoids. The second one's coming out on the 26th. And be sure to get it because they're really great stories. So I'd say keep up the great work because you're doing wonderful things.
Well, thank you so much, Wayne. I really appreciate it, man, for the kind words and and for reading both and taking the time to chat with me. I appreciate it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.